Why don't we, let's go ahead and get started. I'm happy to welcome all of you to this year's holiday lecture. In honor of Wendell Holiday, who many of us knew. Wendell was on the faculty here for 39 years. He served as a faculty member, as dean of the college, and ultimately as provost of the university. And this lecture was established in his honor to bring in a distinguished alumnus of Vanderbilt University each year. And our speaker this year is Robert Grover from Yale, and who is an undergraduate here. I'm going to let Shane do the remainder of the introduction.
So, let me try to get everything correct here. So, Bob Grover was an undergraduate here at Vanderbilt. He then went on and got his master's and PhD degrees from the University of Maryland, College Park, and was a postdoc at AT&T Bell Labs. He joined the Yale faculty in 1994 and is now the Frederick Phineas Rose Professor of Applied Physics at Yale. He started out working in spectroscopy of condensed matter systems, went on to do a lot of work in near-field scanning microscopy. He's also an expert in energy issues, and he told us he's not going to give that talk because it's a bit too depressing nowadays. But he was also on the golf team when he was an undergraduate here at Vanderbilt, has had a lifelong passion for the sport, and has recently started taking a much deeper interest in the physics of the game and looking at the biomechanics of it. So welcome, Bob. We're going to enjoy this. Thanks a lot.
So let me start by saying, so it's a pleasure to be back here at Vanderbilt, and sort of amazed to see how much building has gone on. It's huge here. Can you hear me in the back? Is my voice big enough?
Good.
And it's even nicer to be back to give this Wendell Holiday lecture. In particular, he taught me quantum mechanics. I believe his first semester teaching physics after being provost was the semester he taught us quantum mechanics, which was in the fall of '83. And it's appropriate because I'm teaching quantum mechanics now. And what I remember vividly most of everything was he spent 3 weeks motivating the Schrodinger equation. And we came to class the day he was going to do the Schrodinger equation. You could see he was a little more excited than normal. And he got about halfway through and he was ready to write the Schrodinger equation on the board. And instead, he turned around, ripped open his shirt, turned back again, and emblazoned across his t-shirt was the Schrodinger equation. And I remember thinking, wow, this guy's nuts. But I remember the Schrodinger equation, so and I remember that, and that was wonderful. So let's see, I came here about 6 or 7 years ago and gave a talk on a more serious topic, more serious for other people. This topic is way more serious for a lot of people. But I talk about optics. I'm not going to do that today. I'm going to talk about golf and some of the measurements that I'm making in golf. And so when obsessions collide, physics and golf. And I think it's important to understand, you know, I came to Vanderbilt with the goal of being a golf pro. That's why I came here. Came down to the SEC from way up in the north. And it took me 3 years to learn enough physics and math to do the calculation, what was the likelihood I was going to be successful as a golf pro. And then I became a physicist. And so physics has treated me well, but this obsession never really leaves you. And so lately what I've been doing is putting together my obsessions with both physics and golf, and in particular the physics as an experimentalist. And the outline of what I'm going to talk to you today is all based on what is really a new world of data that happens in golf. Today the standard paradigm in golf is that if you want to learn something about the golf swing, they take a video of you. And then after you're done hitting golf balls, you go and watch the video, and they critique you, and then you try to go back out on the range and somehow correct that. And what's going on today, and you know I'm not the only person doing it, but I think I'm the most successful at it, is putting sensors in golf clubs and actually making measurements in the golf club itself. So you get a lot more data, and you get data from you know where the action is, as opposed to from far away with the video. And so I want to show you two aspects of it. I'll call it qualitative learning and quantitative learning. Qualitative in the sense that it'll just be audio, be stuff, touchy-feely kind of stuff. And then we'll do that for a little bit. Won't do it for a lot. If it was a room full of golfers, I'd spend all the time doing that. But since you're a room full of physicists, I'll tell you a little bit more about the quantitative stuff, about what's coming out. Just so I know, how many golfers? Right. Okay. Good. So it's important. I want to say this here to this group of physicists. So usually, so I went up into a conference with a bunch of golf pros in which they try to talk about science and golf. And the golf pro sitting next to me, a guy named Mike Hebron, who's one of the world's master, there are 2,200 master professionals, and Mike's one of them. And he, like in frustration, with his face all red, he looked at me and said, you know, you scientists spit out numbers that are meaningless, useless, and confusing. And so my talk is real, and I hope you'll see it as physicists, but my talk is really an attempt to explain to the general public what it is a scientist means when a scientist says, I understand something. You know, as opposed to what it means when a golf pro says, they think they understand something. They're very, very different definitions. And in large part, the general population doesn't understand that, you know, when a scientist says that they've explored something, they've done measurements and hypothesis testing and all of this stuff. Whereas, you know, well, I won't get into that. It's a long dialogue, right? So I hope you take that it's really my sort of way of doing science education to the general public. So I have an electronically enabled golf club here. By electronically enabled, I mean it has some sensors on down the shaft. Inside is a microprocessor and some wireless communications. And so there's a real-time data feed that comes off the golf club while you're swinging it. I spent a long time putting lots and lots of sensors in. It wasn't until recently that I figured out how to do something that was simple enough that you could make sense of the measurement immediately. I just want to show you that, you know, everybody says, well, so I basically have stopped doing this stuff that's on your left. I used to do optical spectroscopy, you have a cryostat, nice cold place, you have a stick, you put the thing down into the cryostat. And I just, you know, I try to impress upon people that, you know, it really hasn't changed much, right? Cryostat, data set, into the cryostat, it's all the same geometry. So I haven't, it's not even so creative. But okay, let me see if I can get this up and running. This is always the part you never really know about. There we go. Okay. So I have a real life data feed right now. So this is coming from my golf club. What you see on the lower left side is like a chart recorder. And the sensors, the way they're configured right now, basically measure the motion of the club, basically the speed of the club. And the faster it goes, I should take my jacket off. The faster it goes, the bigger is that signal. And
what kind of number of golf club is that? What is it typically used for?
This is a 5-iron, and it's used for hitting the ball about 180, 190 yards. And but you can put this in any club. You can put this in a sand wedge or a driver. It doesn't really matter. Putter's a little bit different. I'll give you a little cue here. So the hard part about making a measurement in a golf club, see this thing on the lower, oh, so if I take a swing, it's going to clip it, and it's going to save it over on the right-hand side, and I guess I should rescale it for you. But what you see on the lower right-hand side is sort of just an indication how messy the signal is in the shaft of the golf club. It's really, really messy.
What's the measure?
I'm just about to tell you that. Thank you for asking. But what I want to impress upon you is that the signal on the lower right-hand side is really messy. The signal that I'm feeding you right here is really simple. And the signal over there basically is how the golf club rotates. It doesn't measure this. It doesn't measure this. Right? It's measuring rotational motion. And by and large, the golf club is moving rotationally. So that's the signal that's coming out over there. More specifically, I have two accelerometers in here. And if you look at the differential mode signal, you get the rotation. And the signal that I'm going to show you over here is the common mode signal. We'll talk about that at the end of the talk. That's the common. What's common between these two sensors is how the butt of the club is moving, which is how the hands are moving. So this thing you see in the lower right is about the acceleration of the hands. And I'll talk. You all will be experts of that about that in 20 minutes, 25 minutes. Okay. So the question is how to turn this into something useful to a golfer. And for me, the key to playing golf has always been about better tempo. That is, in the game of golf, for very many reasons, the more reproducible you are about the way you do something, the better off you are. And so I was trying to build a tempo trainer. And so my goal was to measure something related to tempo, which is what you see over here, and then turn that into something that you can use real time. And this was my solution. So if you think about what senses you have when you swing, when you play golf, you know, so you have visual, but that's sort of all caught up, and you have sort of taste, but that's a little slow, and you have smell, but that wouldn't be work. And you have sort of, you know, can do electroshock. That's cool. So you know your ears are left, right? So you can listen. So I coded this up so that when you move it slowly, it's low pitched and soft. And And the faster you move it, the higher is the pitch. And it turns out there's a lot you can hear about the golf swing that you have no other way of conveying to somebody. So, for instance, with a beginning golfer, just that the golf swing is rhythmic, that there's actually a rhythm to the golf swing, is news. You know, comparison to what most beginners do, which is, right? Not rhythmic at all. So just being rhythmic is news to most people. Let me give you more dynamic range here. Right. And so there's just the rhythm of the golf swing. Then there are really simple things. When does a club get to its maximum speed, and where is that in relation to the ball? Well, you would hope that the maximum speed happens down by the ball. And, you know, that would sound something... Man, it sounds so good in here. One of the most fun things I did with this, I went in, we were trying to do it wirelessly on a golf course. I needed a wireless setup, and my brother told me, he's a rock and roller, he says, oh, you know, we have all this wireless stuff, you go to a music shop and buy the stuff by Shure. So I went into one of these Guitars R Us kind of stores, it's like Home Depot, but for music, and there are these old 60s rockers in there, and so I was trying to explain what I was doing, and they didn't get it, so I brought it in, and the guy said, wow, we got to put that in the speaker room. So they had this room, it was like a wall of speakers. And, you know, I'm standing up there swinging the club. He says, okay, I'm plugging it in now. And I went and I took the swing, and you could feel like the big woofers. I mean, there was like 8 months of wind. It was. Anyway, sounds great. Okay, so where was I? So the speed of the club. So where does the club get to its maximum speed, and where is that in relation to the ball? So the maximum speed should be down by the ball. Can you hear this? That would be down by the ball. Many, many golfers, there's this whole business about delayed release. They get obsessed with this, and you end up over here with the maximum speed way out here, which is way after the ball. And then there's a whole other class of golfers who get all anxious about everything, and it happens way before the ball. Can you hear it? Just close your eye. Yeah, you have to see, hear the sound and see it correlated with my motion. Can you hear it?
I hear it. I just can't tell if it's matching when you're.
Oh, really? Can anybody see that?
Yeah.
I'm just. That's okay. You know, afterwards we have people come up and swing. That's always fun. We did this morning on a driving range. We learned something about where the speed of the clubs. So there's that. There's all sorts of fun things for better golfers. It turns out the transition is really, really a key in good golfers. And what you'll hear in good golfers is nothing. It gets really quiet back here as they make the transition and builds up. Whereas in poorer golfers, it never gets quiet back there. And you can hear also, like, for instance, here's a fun one. So casting from the top, see if you hear this. Did you hear that? Did you hear that? Casting from the top. So there's a tremendous amount of stuff you can hear about the golf swing that you can't have access to in any other way. And it turns out that it's not useful just from the perspective of tempo. You can get people to change physical aspects of their game, of their swing, which normally would, you know, the golf pro would say, move your hands here, do all this different stuff. Turns out just by getting them to change the way things sound, put the speed over there, make it quiet over here, a little more speed in different places. You can get them to change the way their body works in really dramatic ways without ever telling them anything about moving their body parts in certain particular ways. So the audio has been a lot of fun. And I think so that's what I would call qualitative learning. And for most golfers, just getting a reasonable tempo that's reproducible is incredibly valuable. So any questions about that before I go on to the quantitative stuff? Because it's a physics audience and I want to explain.
Did you guys use this on the links today?
We did use it on the driving range. I have to tell you the truth about using it on the links. I did this at one point in time, start bringing it out on the golf course with me, and I became so dependent on it that I became addicted to it. And then I got uncomfortable that I couldn't hit a shot unless I could hear it. And so I stopped doing it. But, you know, if you can sell things that are addictive, that's generally a profit. So.
Is it allowed by the rules of the game?
Is that allowed by the rules? Very good question. So is it allowed by the rules of the game? And the answer...
Is it still on?
Yeah. I'll just keep doing that. The answer... It's going to be annoying after a while. So the answer is that you're allowed... So there's nothing to prevent you from having electronics in your club as a data logger. you're not allowed to use any external means to hit the golf ball. So in the course of playing a tournament or playing a round that in which you calculate your handicap, you certainly wouldn't be able to use the audio. You would be able to use it as a data logger to look at it after the fact. And for instance, if you were CBS and wanted to use it to enhance, you know, the watch a tournament golf thing, there's no reason why the audience couldn't see and hear it if the golfer didn't. But right, wow, okay. Everybody good with that so far? Are you a golf guy? I see a big V hat. There we go. So there we go. So now I want to do. Now I just want to show you some quantitative things, and so I'll keep this on just because it's fun, but unless it gets annoying. Anyway, so speed of the golf club. This is what I'm going to be showing you for the most part for now. So you can see there's a backswing. Yeah. So there's a backswing, the top of the backswing, down towards impact, the follow through, the after swing foibles, all that kind of stuff. And the first thing I want to show you is the hypothesis that better golfers swing more consistently. Right? So what we can, one thing you can do is just take data on somebody who's hitting balls. This happens to be my nephew, so 16-year-old kid, loaded with testosterone, just ripping at it, you know, shot after shot after shot. But you can see that, you know, every swing is different. So these are 20 swings superimposed on each other. You can see that, in fact, he has two different kinds of backswings, depending upon whether he thinks he's hitting it fat, hard, or whether he thinks he's hitting it slow. They're all linked. They're all, the trigger is right here. So as you go into the backswing or into the downswing, you can see that every swing for this kid is a little bit different, right? But that's because he's about 8 handicap. So this is Pat McGowan. So Pat was a PGA Tour Rookie of the Year, so somebody I would have paid attention to when I was in high school. And this is 7 swings overlap on top of each other. And you can see that this guy really is a walking, talking, breathing metronome, right? Every single swing is exactly the same. And actually, when Pat was hitting, when he was doing some tempo training with this stuff, when he would listen to, I don't know if you remember his swing, he would get it here and then bring it down like that. See that little thing at the end? That's his little after swing. And that's what he would key on. He would always make this sound the same. And that would sort of backpropagate through his swing. You know, the better he did this, the better he hit the ball, because he ended up finishing on balance over here. So everybody listens to something different. In his case, he wanted to listen to this. But the guy's incredibly consistent. So there's hypothesis number one, right? Better golfers are more consistent. You'll find that generically is true. But in particular, this has been looked at in greater detail. So a book came out recently. It's called Tour Tempo by John Novoselt. And he's not a physicist. He's a golf pro. But what he did over the course of 20 years was to video. Has anybody read this book? Anybody read this book? It's a great book. You should read it if you play golf. So he videotaped golfers over the course of 20 years, and he was smart enough to use the frame rate of the camera as a clock. And he would count the number of frames in the backswing and the number of frames in the downswing. And what he noticed was that typically there's a ratio of 3-1, that if it's 24 frames going back, it would be 8 frames coming down. Or if it was 27 frames going back, it would be 9 frames coming down. So he wrote this book called Tour Tempo that said, you know, the magic to the guys on tour is that their ratio is 3-1, backswing time and downswing time. So from the ball to the top and from the top back to the ball again. So I can analyze that data. In particular, I can, you know, go back to this stuff and I can measure precisely the length of the backswing and precisely the length of the downswing. And I don't have to go back and analyze video. I just get it immediately from every shot. And so I've analyzed a lot of golfers. And here's a montage of, or put together, several golfers. We'll later divide them into different categories, tour pros, good amateurs, teaching pros, and sort of everybody else. And what I'm showing you is backswing time and downswing time. And each point, you know, just represents a particular golfer's backswing time and downswing time, one particular point there. And the three lines are the slope. One is, so this middle line here is this tour tempo slope of 3, right? So 600 milliseconds back would be 200 milliseconds down. So that's a slope of 3. And then there's a slope of 3.5 and a slope of 2.5, just to show you. And I want to divide it up for you. So in the top left are tour pros. These are people who play golf for a living. And each data point has error bars associated with it, right? What is the variance? So each data point represents 10 or 20 swings. And so there's variance in the backswing and variance in the downswing. And what you notice for these guys is that the variance is very, very small, right? Everything is reproducible for these people. And the other thing is that it's so tightly clustered. I mean, you can ask, why is it that all of, I mean, there's a huge range of possibilities, right? But they all seem to cluster in this tiny little region. And what I'm going to do is explain to you in the next 15 minutes why that is. Whoops. Oh, this is fun. So why do they cluster? Then if you look at these people here, these are teaching pros and great amateurs. They are never faster than tour pros. They're either just as fast or slower. Everybody else gets slower. And the slower they get, the more variance they get. And they all sort of live not at the tour tempo 3-to-1, but they sort of live in this span from 2.5 to 3.5. You know, the ratio of back some time to down some time. And then in the top left, you'll see there's everybody else, the rest of us. So you can ask the question, why is it that these tour pros cluster way up here like this? I mean, you know, it doesn't really matter where they're from. Are they from Europe? Are they from the US? Are they from Japan? It doesn't seem to matter. I haven't told you whether they're hitting 5-irons or drivers or full swings or part. It doesn't really matter. It's always sort of right at this tempo. And so the question is, well, can you find a way to explain that? Why is it there such small variance? Why is the swings are all roughly the same? Why is everybody else slower? And to me, that sounds like a clock. Right? So the question is there some clock that's keeping these guys going? And my assumption was, well, maybe, so, you know, a clock. So the simplest model of a clock is just a harmonic oscillator. I don't have to tell you guys that. This is my, you know, physics for golfers. Sort of story. So the simplest model of a clock is a harmonic oscillator, and the reason it makes a good model for a clock is that it doesn't depend upon the amplitude of the motion, right? The frequency at which it's going to go is just its resonant frequency. So it doesn't matter whether it's a small amplitude or a big amplitude, it's always going to run at the same resonant frequency. And in principle, of course, if you know the spring constant and the mass, I can tell you the resonant frequency. So the question is, can you model the golf swing as a spring? As a harmonic oscillator? In particular, my picture was that the torso is some big spring. So it has some spring constant associated with it. And the mass is everything that's hanging off of it. And when you begin the golf swing, you begin by pushing all this mass going backwards. So you begin by winding things up. And look at this. This is going to be fun. So you wind up, and then you get to the top of your swing, and then you apply the force in the other direction, and you push back. And then you unwind the spring. So you wind the spring up, and then you unwind the spring. And there's a built-in asymmetry there, simply because in one case, so when you wind it up, you're working against the spring. And then when you come down the other direction, you're working with the spring. And so there's a fundamental asymmetry. Of course, to your audience of physicists, to understand what you're really doing is shifting the equilibrium point around, right? So, you know, just because you've gotten back to the ball doesn't mean you've actually gotten back to the equilibrium point, which is why it's less time to go down to the beginning than it is to go back. And so you can use just the simple model of a harmonic oscillator and say, well, can I calculate this ratio of backswing to downswing time as a function of how much force I use to apply going back and how much force I use to go down? So if you push back with the same force that you push down, it turns out you get a ratio of 2.5 to 1. That is 2.5 times length to go back as it takes to go down. If I push down with twice the force as what I push back, you get a ratio right at 3-to-1, which is where tour tempo is. If you pull down 3 times as hard, you're at 3.5 to 1. So, you know, just the simple picture of a harmonic oscillator gets you into the right range of numbers. So I went and told my golf pro friends, I think, in fact, timing in the golf swing comes from the fact that the body acts like a big spring. And they all laughed and said, look, no spring. So that's pretty serious, right? I mean, I have to respond to that. And so first I had to figure out why it is that every golf pro I talked to, without question, said there's no spring action in the body. The body doesn't function like a spring. And where I found it was in this book called The Search for the Perfect Swing. And again, if you're a golfer and haven't read it, especially if you're a scientist, you should read this. This was a study commissioned in the 60s by the Royal Ancient Golf Association and I think it was just the RNA. And they brought together golfers and scientists. And the problem was the golfers didn't understand science and the scientists didn't understand golf. But they got together for 2 or 3 years and tried to figure out everything they could figure out about the golf swing as it relates to physics. And they wrote this book called The Search for the Perfect Swing. And in it, there's this unfortunate statement which says, the common attempt to represent the golfer as winding up a big spring in his trunk, however vivid the colors of the drawing, is really far from the mark. And so they said right from the beginning, the spring has nothing to do with the golf swing. And so everybody sort of believes that from now on, or at least the golf pros do. So then I decided, well, the golf pros maybe aren't good enough to talk to you, so I need to go talk to a biomechanics guy. So at Yale, we have this wonderful guy, Jacek Czelewicki. And so he's a Polish powerlifter, all about muscle. And I told him my little story, you know, that all these golf pros swing with the same time, and, you know, it must be that there's a clock, and I calculated the harmonic oscillator, it's just about right. Do you believe that? And he said, oh, yeah. And I said, why do you believe that so right, so quickly? And he said, well, the thing that we've learned about elite athletes is that what distinguishes the elite athlete from everybody else is the ability to store and recover energy elastically in their body. And so if it's true about runners and jumpers and everybody that they've studied, why shouldn't it be true about golf pros? And so then he gave me a little lecture as to why it is that these elite athletes are able to do it. And of course, Jacek's about powerlifting, so he gave me the story from the perspective of a powerlifter. So imagine you start to do bench press. What is it that you're doing when you bench? So you first start to do bench press, you can't do very much weight. And in the first 2 or 3 weeks, all of a sudden you can do a lot more weight. Oh, look how strong I'm getting. And then it kind of plateaus for a while. It takes a long time before you can put more weight on the bar. And so the question is, do you get stronger in that first week? Those first couple weeks? And the answer is no. What really happens is when you push the bar up, there's a whole set of muscle groups that help you push the bar up. And there's another set of muscle groups that pull the bar down. And in fact, you're firing both of those sets of muscles. And that you're firing both muscle groups gives you stability. And that as you learn technique, you learn just to use that set of muscle groups that aid in your motion. And you use less of those muscles that work against you. And so to the extent in the first couple weeks that you're able to put more weight on the bar just meant that you learned better technique. That is, you're able just to use that set of muscles that help your motion. So it turns out that if you want to use the body as a spring, you have to use just that set of muscle group that actually is aiding your motion. If you have these counter-opposing muscle groups, you cancel out all of that effect. And then there's the issue, well, the body isn't really a spring, but it turns out there are natural motions that the body can learn, or even that the body does without thinking about it, which are spring-like. So for instance, what's a spring? It's just a restoring force. Right? So if you take your arm and you throw it out at high enough speed, your bicep fires in an attempt to keep you from breaking your elbow. Right? So that's a natural sort of built-in spring-like response. Right? It's just a restoring force going in the other direction. And it turns out good athletes will learn to use their bodies just like a spring. So the question is, could we prove that that the torso in the golf swing was more like a spring? And so Jacek and I designed an experiment that I'm just about to show you. But to do that experiment, I had to have a place to hit golf balls. And so I went into my optics lab, and I moved the optical benches. I have two labs, so I took most of the expensive equipment and moved it in the other lab. And then I took the benches and moved them to the side, and I went out and I bought a net, much to the chagrin of my colleagues, I'm sure. And so now we hit golf balls in my lab. See how long they keep that space assigned to me. And we came up with the following experiment. So this is Nate Hunt, who's on the Yale golf team. The experiment was as follows. We wanted to see if the torso acts like a spring. So the first thing we have to do is apply a force. So we have this rope attached to the golf club, which is attached to a load cell. And we say, okay, make a golf swing. So the guy tries to make a swing, but of course he can't because he's tied to this rope, which is measuring how much force he's applying. So you measure how much force he's applying, and as soon as you make that measurement, it takes about a second to cut the rope. And then as soon as you cut the rope, he moves in response. Just, it happens. And we put a gyroscope on his back so we can measure how the torso moved in response to the supply of force. So, right.
But does he over-push against the rope at first and then snap? Is it break?
Here's what first off, this is standard procedure in biomechanics. Okay. As far as I can, I mean, that's what they tell me. You measure the applied force and you look at the response. And I've done this myself. It's pretty straightforward. You pull just a little bit. As soon as that thing breaks, you don't know when it's going to break. As soon as it breaks, you move in response. I mean, you're applying force and you move in response. And you'll see in the end, I don't know if the force is way back here. Maybe it's the same, maybe it isn't. Won't really matter. But at least I know what the initial force is. And then we watch how things evolve from there.
Can't you get the initial force just by using the sensors in your club there, by looking at the acceleration?
That's a great question. The answer is no. I would have to know exactly what the... Maybe now I can do that. I would have to know exactly the inertial properties of everything, and are you translating? I'll show you later, I think... I'll show you later that I think I've made that measurement, but I trust this one better.
Sure.
So this is the output of the gyroscope, and we can measure some simple things. We can measure, what's the maximum angle through which this guy rotated, right? That's the peak. And then we can measure how long it took to get to that peak. How long it took to get from here to the peak. And we can do that as a function of how much force he applies. And if it's a spring, you can predict two things. The time to go from here to here should be the resonant frequency of the spring. Shouldn't matter how much force you apply. Shouldn't matter how far back you go. Go a little or you go a lot. Should be the same time if it's just a spring. And the other thing is that the harder I push, the further back I should go. And it should be linear if it's a spring. So that was the hypothesis on the test. And so here's, first off, the timing data. So this is the length of the backswing for a particular golfer as a function of the amount of force that's applied from a little chip shot to a full swing. And it turns out it's right at the tour tempo time of about 750 milliseconds. And okay, that's just a, you know, that straight line is really just the average. It's just the mean, right? Maybe there's a little tilt to it. But to first order and for within the context of biomechanics, which isn't, you know, perfect accuracy, it's a pretty good result. Now, from this result, knowing that the time to go back was 750 milliseconds, I can then go in and make an estimate for what I think the inertial properties of the system are. You can measure the inertial properties of the golf club. You can go back and read these books where they take cadavers and cut them up, and they measure the inertial properties of the arms and the torso and the legs. It's gruesome, but biomechanics people do this, and they taught me how. So then you can make an estimate of this, of the inertia. And if you know the time and the inertia, you can guess the spring constant. And so the blue line is a guess, knowing the inertial properties of the body and the time of the backswing as to what the spring constant should be. And if you know the spring constant, then I can tell you the maximum distance that you went as a function of the amount of force. And here's the data. So it's not too bad to begin with, right? It begins sort of linear, and then it sort of saturates. So you can ask, well, what is that saturation? Well, it's just simply that you can't push your torso back forever or you'll break your back. So it turns out that biomechanics people have studied this. They have these sort of horrific-looking contraptions where they sit people down and they apply this thing and they start applying force and they start rotating this guy, I assume, until he screams. But they can definitely, you know, look at the amount of force as a function of rotation, and in fact, it's a function that saturates in a well-defined way. And we could use that nonlinear model actually to explain what happens in the golf swing. So that's the red curve. So in fact, I would say pretty... Now, why fit it to this? Really what I'm doing is extracting the linear part out of this so that I can get to exactly what is the inertia. And it turns out it agrees pretty well. That is, you know, the timing and the time of this thing and the inertia of the body give you roughly the right answers. So I believe pretty strongly now that, in fact, the timing of the golf swing is really defined, at least for elite golfers, is really defined in terms of those people using their body as a spring. And if you look at a good golfer swing with that in mind, it's pretty obvious. Any questions about that? Yep.
If you look at different professional, different sports, there's usually a sort of body shape and form that they all converge to. I mean, bicycle riders, they all look the same very much. So do the golfers have this figured out already? I mean, based on what you say, that should depend on the size of arms and how muscular they are and all that. Are they sort of conformed to that, or is it their broad scatter?
John Dillon.
Yeah, so you know, I mean, I have a very cynical answer to that. I mean, golf is evolving towards athleticism, right? More and more golfers look like athletes. They're all 6'4". They have really long moment arms, unlike me. I have a pretty short moment arm. So they're evolving to that. But, you know, 30 years ago, golf pros were mostly just drunks. I mean, that's just true. And so, you know, people like Tiger Woods has changed that in a big way. He's a serious athlete, and golf pros are becoming increasingly, you know, more serious athletes. I know when I played golf here at Vanderbilt, our freshman year, we had Jess Neely. Jess Neely was the ex-football coach here, a Hall of Famer, you know, used to coach at Clemson, and he retired to be the golf coach. That was about how serious they took the golf team. And when Jess retired, then they got the next golf coach was a physiologist, Larry Shavers, and he required that we went and lifted weights. And so we went into what was the weight room back then. I'm sure it was much smaller than what it is now. You know, people are like, what are you guys doing here? So, you know, it's only recently that people have taken golf as extreme an athletic event as bicycle riders, if you want. And so my guess is they will all evolve to the same geometry. But, you know, we still have the John Daly's, right? So it turns out the harmonic oscillator picture of tempo helps us really understand a lot about tempo. It helps us describe not just the ratio of backswing to downswing, but the overall timing. It tells us why the 5-iron and the driver and the half swing and the full swing are all the same tempo, because it doesn't matter. It's just the resonant frequency of what you're swinging. It tells why everyone else is slower. Everyone else is slower because they're using all these other muscle groups that they shouldn't be using. Or they're having motions which are inefficient, which just act as drag on the system and just slows you down. Nobody goes faster than their natural resonance. And it's why golf pros in the end look like they're swinging slowly. They're doing something which is incredibly natural for them, right? They're swinging at resonance, and to swing that fast, you actually have to make everything very efficient. There's no sort of random motion in their swings. In order to swing that fast, they have to be efficient. And I would argue it's more about the clock than the amount of stored energy, but that's another discussion. So there's a ton of other stuff that we've been studying using this. I'm going to tell you one more story about the release, simply because we talked about it this afternoon, or this morning. And that's a great story. But there's enough this kind of science associated with golf, you know, simple biomechanics, what can you say about the golf swing, that next semester I'm teaching a course at Yale just on the physics of golf, and it's an introductory physics course disguised as a golf course, in which we're going to do all of the standard stuff you do in the first semester of introductory physics, even statistics, but we're going to do it within the context of golf. So there's a long syllabus, 13 chapters. But I'm just going to tell you the physics of the release. Any questions before I go on? How are we doing? All bored? Golfers good with this? Okay. So you saw there were two signals, right? The one that we've been talking about so far is derived from the differential mode signal, which gets you this kind of motion. But then there's this common mode signal, which I'm showing you in the bottom panel there. And you know, all these bumps and wiggles. And so I want to explain to you what this common mode means. So first off, it's basically, you know, the common mode is the motion of the hands. So I think of it as the acceleration of the hands. Are the hands speeding up or are the hands slowing down? And you can have a positive number, a number greater than zero, which means your hands are accelerating. You can have a negative number, less than zero, which means the hands are slowing down. And what I want to draw your attention to is what happens in the vicinity of impact. So you see this big rise and then this dip. It's a very key signal. So first off, notice that the rise and the dip happens just before impact. So this is all going on in this region out here as you're coming down. And the big rise, of course, is that there's big acceleration. That is, as you go from standstill down to here, your hands are accelerating at an enormous rate. But then what happens, you build up all this kinetic energy of motion in the system. Hands, arms, body, the whole thing's got all this kinetic energy. The idea is to get that kinetic energy out to the golf club. And so there's this release that occurs. And the release happens for all sorts of fun reasons. There's the hand supplies some force. There are big centripetal forces that pull this thing out. So there are all sorts of good reasons why the club releases. But when the club releases, as the club is speeding up, if you make the assumption that energy is roughly conserved, everything else has to be slowing down. And in fact, that's what happens to the hands. The harder, the more efficient you are getting energy out to the club head, the more the hands slow down. And that's what that big dip is. So as you swing the club in your downswing, as you go from the top, the hands speed up, and then as the club releases, the clubs speed up and the hands slow down. And so you get this structure. It turns out that this structure, which is all about the release, is a huge discriminator. It allows you to pick out the difference between a really great golfer and a pretty good golfer and a horrible golfer. So this is a montage of four golfers. And in each case, that's okay, we've thrown these things from long distances. Okay, so here's golfer A, golfer B, golfer C, golfer D. And if you look at the differential mode signal, which is what you listen to, they all have roughly the same structure. You could argue certainly that this guy gets more rotation, you know, this guy gets it going faster than this guy, and you can tell these two people hit the ball pretty hard. But if you look at the details of the release, here's the professional golfer. Big acceleration, big deceleration, right? Build up the kinetic energy and get it out to the golf club. So here's a good amateur. Not so big acceleration, but you know, reasonable release. But it's not nearly as well developed and as wide as what you see in the professional golfer. And here are some hacks, right? It just never happens for them, right? It just never happens. So here's another montage. So. Who can pick out the professional golfer? Remember, you need the big peak and the big dip.
Top right.
And this is a good amateur, right? But that's a pro. Here's an okay golfer, and here's someone who's just beginning, right? So it turns out, so we have a pretty quantitative measure of the release and how efficient you are getting energy out to the golf club. I just want to show you a couple of examples of sort of the process I went through when I started understanding how important this was. So here is a particular tour pro, and first off, you can see this guy's just incredibly reproducible. And here's the release. Big acceleration, big deceleration. Now, what I haven't told you, this is 10 swings, and three of these swings are full, and I mean, seven of the swings are full swings, and three of them are three-quarter swings. And while you can't distinguish the three-quarter swings from the full swings when you look at the total tempo, if you look at the release, you can see right here. See the three-quarter swing? And here are the full swings. So you can actually see, you know, he basically didn't get the energy out to the ball. He was holding back. I was trying to explain to him how important this was. And I figured a reasonable figure of merit is the distance between the peak and the valley. And I was measuring that in units of acceleration, meters per second squared. And I said, you know, yours is like 100 meters per second squared. I mean, that's great. And he just looked at me like I was an idiot. And so I knew I had needed a common language, you know, something that he would understand. And so I said, oh, it's about 10 Gs. Gs? Like fighter pilot Gs? I said, yeah, you pull about 10 Gs. He said, wow. And so standing next to, you know, the next tour pro I took data on was somebody whom they both knew each other, a smaller guy who doesn't hit the ball quite as far, but who won this year. And so, you know, again, incredibly reproducible, but, you know, he only pulls 8 Gs, 8.5. And, you know, he was upset. So this is a guy who hits the ball long for a living. So he doesn't hit the ball straight for a living. He hits the ball long. Whereas most golfers will hit this 5-iron, most good golfers will hit this 5-iron from 185 to 195 or 200 or something like that. This guy was hitting the ball with this club about 280. I mean, it was unbelievable. It was scary. But look at this. It's 20 Gs. I've never seen anything like it. But, you know, that's what he did, right? He applied huge torque in the beginning, and then he was really great about getting that energy out to the golf ball. So it's really simple. You want to hit the golf ball hard, apply a lot of torque, and then transfer the energy from the body to the ball, body to the clubhead.
So what allowed him to do that? Big wrists or big arms or what?
Well, so first off, he's tall, 6'4", maybe, big tall guy, and pretty strong but really fast. I mean, he was just fast. And, well, I can tell you my fast story. Some people are just faster than others. It's just how they are. So I have a friend, I was describing this to a friend of mine who does neurophysiology kind of stuff, and he said, they did this experiment, he was at McGill at the time, and he said they did these experiments where they put an electrode in your arm, and then they put a sensor up here, and they'd fire this and see how long it takes to go up your arm. You know, you do this to a couple hundred kids, randomly chosen from the student body, and get a nice bell curve. Some people are fast, some people are slow. And you do this, you know, again, pick another couple hundred kids, you get the same curve, the same. You do this to the football team, and they're all on the upper edge, right? It's just, some people are faster, right? That guy was just faster. I don't know why. Faster than me, for sure. Okay, so now I just want, again, just to finish with a little physics. So here we have a bunch of signals. Hopefully now you understand what these things mean and why they're important. Question is, can I put them back together and make them look like a golf swing? And in particular, it's two sensors. That's all I have in here. It's a simple measurement. Question is, can I find a model which has two parameters? If you have two sensors, you'd like to have no more than two parameters. And can I convert that back into a golf swing, and then is that useful? And the model I use is the double pendulum model for golf. I didn't invent it. It came out of this book, Search for the Perfect Swing. And it's the following simplification. One pendulum is just the golf ball. Okay? The other pendulum is a line from your hands to your hub. And it has the inertia of everything folded into it. So imagine a line from your hands to your hub, and then your golf club. And that's the double pendulum model. And you can, of course, measure the inertial properties of everything. So you can make that pendulum pretty well defined. For those of you who know this book, Ted Jorgensen's book, The Physics of Golf, is really just an application of Lagrangian of the double pendulum to golf. That's what he really wrote about. Now, back when he wrote this book, back in 1968, of course, he just had, you know, video, which wasn't easy to handle, and they had new strobe lights, and it wasn't as detailed a measurement as what we could do now, But it, what I'm doing is no more complicated than what he did back then, just with a different sensor system. So, two, you know, it's easy, 2 degrees of freedom. So that data set I just showed you is this now. So you can convert that back into the golf swing. This is actually Charlotte Mayorkas. I'm very proud. She just qualified for the PGA Tour. She finished a second in the future. So that's her golf swing. That's that data. So, you know, I'm doing the good physicist thing. I'm taking the data and I'm converting it back into, you know, what it really came from. Now, there are approximations in this. I only have two parameters. So, you know, the hub could translate. I'm assuming the hub is stationary. You can change planes. I'm not sensitive to any of that sort of stuff. But in a good golfer, their hub doesn't translate and the plane doesn't change. Now, you could say, well, what good is this? This is no better than video. Faster frame rate, but it looks just like video, except that I have the data points. But I also know the inertia components of these things. So I can calculate the torque that you apply. So what you see on the right is the torque that's applied to the hub in red, and in blue is the torque applied at the hands. And that's calculated from the fact that I know the inertia properties of everything. If I know the inertial properties, I can say, well, what force did it take to move it into that position? And so you can calculate the torque. And what you'll find is that the maximum torque doesn't happen down at by the ball. You know, that's why the transition is so important. The maximum torque happens way back here, where your body is moving relatively slowly, where you can apply huge forces. So that's the first thing that's interesting. Now, somebody asked me a question about why don't you measure the force with your with your sensors in the swing. I can't forget who asked me that question. So if you look right here, see this straight line here? This is the spring winding up. See the red line here? So what happens is, down here, this is the force I'm applying. It's a negative force backing me up. And as you wind up, you coil up that spring. And you apply, the spring is applying a linear force going forward. So the further I get back, it's a combination of the force pushing back and the spring pushing forward. And that linear, that slope is basically a measure of the spring constant, if you want. So that's the measurement there. You can see it in the swing. Everybody good with that? So that's an important piece of information. How much torque do people apply? Where do people apply it in the swing? It's not where you think it is. You don't apply torque way down here by the golf ball because you can't apply torque when your body's moving that fast. You apply all this torque way back up here, and well, that's another conversation. Anyway, another thing you can do. So this is the fun part. So the question is, can you use this information to improve your golf swing? And this is clearly my midlife crisis. So if I were to claim this was about anything other than making me a better golfer, I'd be lying, right? So I'm the guinea pig. I've been the guinea pig for a year now, and let me just show you the evolution of my swing because I've been taking data now for the last year. So, you know, I played golf here for a while. You know, I was okay, but I wasn't great. And then I didn't play for a long time because I was raising a family and getting tenure and all of that crap. So here I was, you know, when I started this project. This is what my swing looked like. And, you know, maybe not so great, not so bad, but really not very reproducible. And if you look at the times, you know, the backswing is about 900 milliseconds. It's much longer than a regular backswing. And here's that same sort of data, but over on the right, you can see my release structure. And in fact, you know, I was sort of at about 7.5 Gs. So I was okay. You know, I'm an okay golfer back then. I'm an okay golfer now. So let me just show you the evolution of this. So first off, there's just what happens if you just use the audio biofeedback. And you go from, you can sort of see how much consistency there is here to more consistency here. Can you see that? Mm-hmm. Just using the audio, not knowing anything about the timing and the spring and all of that stuff, just becoming more consistent with you. And that's very useful. Just becoming more consistent as a golfer is a very useful process. If someone asks me a question about that, I can talk at great length about where the golf club is relative to your hands, et cetera. And so now what I understood about the release, and I've been working on my release for a while. And let me just show you where I am now. So this is my release now. So, you know, that's, admittedly, that's after a half an hour on a driving range with my laptop running, looking at every swing, saying, okay, what's it take to get me up there? If I just go out to a driving range on my own right now, I'm at 10 or 11 or 12 Gs or something like that. To get up to 13 and a half, takes a huge effort. But the point is, somebody, you know, a 44-year-old physicist can learn this. And you know, do I hit the ball, you know, I hit the ball hard. I have a shorter moment arm, so I'm battling against that. But still, for a person with a pretty short moment arm, I hit the ball reasonably respectably.
Well,
so
to go straight when you hit the that hard. I mean, you're pushing your to get the maximum.
That's right.
Distance. So are you? But are you getting it straight?
More than it ever has in my life. That's not to say I don't hit it offline. Everybody hits it offline.
So,
but I
like
hit it more reliably straight now than I ever have, simply because my swing is more reproducible than it's ever been. And I have this problem as a physicist that I never, ever do the same thing twice. I'll go out tomorrow, and I'll be thinking about some other biomechanical thing. And so I don't do the thing a good athlete would do, which is figure out a way to do it and do that every single day.
Yeah.
But I am much more reproducible than I've ever been. And I hit the ball harder than I ever have.
Yeah, no, that's what I was thinking, because your distance golfer wasn't always hitting it straight. But
no, that's right. That's right. Okay. So there, it's a good midlife crisis.
I'm done.
Let's see. So, yeah.
Are you planning to commercialize this?
Yeah.
how was it funded?
Would you like to contribute? So let's see. I spent, this is a long dialogue. The short answer is that I spent a year and a half trying to raise money for this. I haven't been very successful. I just hired a CEO. We have our first little round of seed money. We're still collecting money. We have enough to get going now. The nice thing is, as you know, so I'm a physicist. I can do 80% of everything and 100% of nothing, which means, you know, I have all the electronics worked out. I've written software, but, you know, the program crashes, and I've got this electronics in here, but every now and then, you know, the wireless doesn't work quite right. If you're in a, you know, the airplane's flying overhead, screw with you. So, you know, we have to make this done right, and that's why you raise money, right? And the more I've worked on it, the less money we need, and that's what we're doing. And it's a long and interesting story, this process of going from academia to starting a business. I think it's...
But the original research in this, was it funded by anyone? Or
I was funded by me, much to the chagrin of my wife.
No NSF funding.
No NSF funding and
no golf association funding.
You know, what's that?
No golf association funding.
Yeah, I've asked the USGA if they'd be interested in funding it. The answer is no. the USGA is interested in measuring golf equipment. They view this as a commercial. You know, they don't invest in commercial products. And the other thing is, you know, I could talk. I should stop talking on this. But let me just say, so I approach this as a physicist, right? I'm going to take some data. I'm going to interpret the data. That hasn't happened. You know, the standard business model. So first off, I view this as, you know, what equipment will be like 10 years from now. You'll go buy your $400 golf club, and there'll be electronics in it. I don't know if it'll be in the head, in the shaft. Is it going to be exactly the same measurement I'm making now, or some other measure? But there will be electronics in golf equipment 10 years from now. I'm 100% confident in that. People don't view it like that. People view it as a training tool in golf. And the standard business model for a training tool in golf is, how do I make a million pieces, market it, sell it in 12 months, and get out before people realize it's useless? That's the standard business model. And as soon as you bring them a business model that says, no, I actually have something that helps people become better golfers, they just look at you like you're a nut. They bring you to Golf Around the World webpage, and they say, look, you and all of these other 1,500 people who made all these golf widgets.
Is there a move by purists to ban putting electronics in golf clubs?
Not yet, because they don't know about us, but they will.
In that regard, when you say the golf club 10 years from now will have electronics, I would agree, but I would have thought it would be kind of nanoelectronics, the same kind of thing as skis, namely things that can, you know, if you're not applying the right torque, that it can adjust the tension of the club to improve the torque transfer and things
right.
like that.
So skis have these little things
yeah.
which, in principle, damp
yeah.
the ski. Do they?
I don't think they do, but
good.
But do you think, but my question was, do you think that it will be possible, based on this kind of analysis, to make clubs that compensate for or improve the torque transfer and things like that?
Okay, I don't know the answer to that, but let me, so that invites the following thing, which is, why is golf hard? Okay. And why is actually tempo, why am I so convinced that tempo is the right way to go about it? So it turns out at impact, the following happens. The golf club looks like this, because the center of mass of this goes along here, right? The other thing that happens is that this thing has come back, and then by the time you get to the ball, it's done this. And the other thing is you get this big, you know, this you know, your index ellipsoid is off axis here. So this thing torques around like that. So it turns out that in the swing of a golfer who hits the ball hard, the relationship of the golf club to the hands at impact is nowhere near where it was at address. And in particular, if you do this on Iron Byron, which is the golf ball hitting machine at the USGA, if this is the golf ball, you have to set it up like this, because it rotates over and it comes around like this and bends down. And if you were to line it up square, you would barely, just about miss the ball. So, you know, they go through this process where a technician, 5 or 6 or 10 times, will have it hit and puts a little marker here until he gets it right in the middle. So the process of hitting a golf ball is about learning where is this. And every time you swing it with a different pace, with a different profile, the golf club is actually in a different place relative to your hand. I didn't really come to understand this until I got fitted for clubs. That was a big rage that started some time ago. And, you know, when I did this, I went out on a range with a guy whom I knew, a golfer whom I worked for a lot of years, and went out there, I was hitting a 5-iron, I was hitting great. And he puts this other 5-iron in my hand, he says, okay, you're going to hit this high and right. And I looked at him and said, don't you get it? I'm hitting it straight. He said, no, you hit high and right. Sure enough, like, as much as I try to hit it straight, I hit it high and right. And 3 or 4 or 5 shots later, I got it going straight. And then he gave me my old club again. And where did I hit it? Low and left. 3 or 4 more times to get it. So, you know, as humans, whatever it is we do, we figure out how to hit the golf ball straight.
Some of us.
Some of us. So I really think designing a piece of equipment that's going to do that with all of those forces involved, I mean, you're going to have, you know, I don't think that's going to happen. But I think if you can convert people into more regular tempo, instead of listening to your iPod, listen to your golf swing, or convert your golf swing into a ringtone so that, you know. Let's see, I'm going to go there, and then there, and then there, and then there.
So what was your handicap before you started using this technology, and what is it now?
So my handicap before I started doing this was my job, my wife, and my kids. And I have the same handicap.
With graphite and steel shafts, because it seems like you see a shift in where the peak would be.
Yeah, great question. The answer is no. I've only done this in steel, and for a good reason. This is designed to fit right inside the standard idea of an inner diameter of a steel shaft. The graphite shafted wall has a little bit bigger idea, and so the circuit boards that I made by myself are a little too big to put inside a graphite shaft right now, but you can believe that we're going there. There and then there. I'm sorry, hand up there.
So what have you learned either from your machinery or experience on how far back to bring the club? And do all the pros tend to be standard with how far back they bring the club?
Well, the short answer is I've learned nothing. I don't know anything on that subject. I think you bring it back until you're done winding up, and or how far you want to hit it. You know, the more you wind it up, the further. But that has to do with how flexible you are. So I don't really have a good answer for
that. And how much you break your wrists, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know the answer.
One more?
On a double.
So, wait, I can tell you. Go ahead.
The first is, have you tried this for baseball bats, baseball swing?
Right.
And the second is, why do golf balls hit nipples?
Okay, so I have to, let me start by saying the following thing. So I've been, you know, for 20 years I gave physics talks. And the standard physics talk is you give a 15-minute talk, and afterwards there are 2 or 3 polite questions, and then you go off and have dinner. And I've been giving this golf talk now for a year or a year and a half. And generally it's not a room full of physicists, it's a room full of golfers. And we do 50 minutes, and then we get in the question session. And that goes on for 50 minutes. And then they all come up to start swinging. And in the end, we do this until they kick us out of the venue. So this can go on for a long time, and I'm happy to entertain questions for a long time, but it generally goes on for a long time, which is the fun part about giving golf talk. Okay, your first question was, why not baseball bats? So first off, my passion is you can do this in a baseball bat, same motion. Do this in fly fishing pole, do this for bowling, anything where you're swinging. Actually, my neighbor strapped it to her arm and danced around my yard one day. It was beautiful. So she was the instrument. So there's all sorts of interesting things you can conceive of doing. My passion is golf. And from a business perspective, we looked at baseball. It turns out that if you sell this, if you want to put together this electronics to sell it in a golf club, there's a standard multiplier in the consumer electronics industry, which is you take your price of electronics and multiply by 8. That's just sales, distribution, all of that stuff. So it turns out if you do that, you end up at about $300. So you can sell $300 golf clubs, but you can't sell $300 baseball bats. So I haven't looked at baseball bats yet. I would look at baseball bats if either A, my son was into baseball, or my daughter was into baseball, or if Major League Baseball asked me to do it. But short of that, I don't think I'll be doing baseball bats so quickly. Though, you know, when the price of cost of goods gets down to something compatible with baseball, we'll do that. Why do golf balls have dimples? You really want me to do that?
No.
Okay, so I am not an aerodynamicist, but this is what I think I understand. You know, so as the golf ball's flying through the air, you get this laminar flow near it, and in the back, you'll get a turbulent region, right? And as the golf, the more laminar flow you have on this thing, the more drag there is. And when the turbulent starts to kick in, I think there's less drag. But what I know is that as this thing goes faster, this turbulent region starts to move forward. And there comes a time in the flight of the golf ball when it moves all the way forward. And all of a sudden, the air drag drops by like a factor of 2. And so the golf ball flies in this region where it's completely surrounded by this turbulent region of air. And for that reason, it flies further. And so the dimples help make things turbulent. That's my lay physics sort of thing. I'm not an aerodynamicist, but I've seen these pretty pictures and I've talked with guys who understand it in much greater detail. But it is really true that as a function of speed, that there's all of a sudden this transition, and this is where you fly out here. It's actually as a function of Reynolds numbers.
So it's to make it fly further rather than to make it fly straight.
It makes it fly further. It's lower drag.
The textbook we're using in computational physics, it has a whole section on dimples and golf balls, and they're actually computational problems. It's the same physics.
I need that for my golf classes.
Yeah, I can show it to you. It's the same physics. The same physics as pitches on baseballs.
Huh. So it's a purpose for the stitches. It's not
yes.
Stitches.
Well, it's more complicated, but it's I can assign the problems.
I would have